Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, October 27th. Today we hear from the state tax office as it tries to go after those advertising short-term vacation rentals without paying the transit accommodation tax as required by law. We meet a shopper stretching $60 a month in food benefits. Next month's assistance won't be provided as the federal government shutdown drags on. We take a closer look at a film that shared a top prize at the Hawaii International Film Festival, why it's tied to news headlines in Samoa and Hawaii. And we look at how Filipino communities are leaving their mark on hip-hop music. Plus, we introduce you to HPR's newest classical musical host, Marcus Moore. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, it's been almost 5 years since the counties began getting serious about passing new laws to make the regulation of vacation rentals easier to enforce. This morning, we talked to the state tax office about a recent legal notice that caught our eye. It listed the names of 18 people or entities that were in violation of the law by not disclosing their tax information in their advertising on platforms like Airbnb or VRBO. Gordon Zane is with the Special Enforcement Division for the state's tax office. He explains a requirement.
What you saw was the a legal notice with regard to the aspect of the law, transit and accommodation law, that basically requires people to display their tax registration numbers. And the reason for that is the legislature, I believe, in their wisdom, decided that one of the ways that we can control the transient accommodation activities and the filing of taxes for those activities is by requiring people to list their tax registration numbers in their advertisements for their vacation rentals. So when people don't do that, that's how their names or their ads come to our attention. And when that happens, we then send warnings to these people, let them know that, hey, there's a statute out there that requires you to display your tax registration number. And we try and give them that forewarning so that they can correct that number. We give them time in which they can perhaps remedy their number. But if that doesn't happen, then we have to issue a citation. The penalty for not complying with the law is $500 per day for a first day of violation.
And what can you tell us? Like, how long has the state been doing this? Have you, stepped up recently? And what's the compliance rate?
This has been going on quite a long time, at least since 2020. We've been sending out letters to people telling them about the laws and what they need to do to be in compliance. But we've noticed with the explosion, I guess, of vacation rentals platforms like Airbnb or VRBO, that there's a lot more people that have gotten involved in this kind of short-term rental activity. And so we're basically ramping up, as far as the state's concerned, we're ramping up our efforts and our focus on these people and the ads that they have.
To what extent do you work with the counties? Because I know each county, has been trying to find a good way to tackle this problem. I mean, is there a sharing of information? How does that work?
We have, from time to time, collaborated with the city and county. But it's a little different because with the cities and counties, a short-term rental is defined as 30 days or less if you're renting something. But for the state and tax purposes, it's 180 days or less. So if you're renting a property for 180 days or less, that comes under our transient accommodation laws. And so it's a different requirement, a different standard that the state and the county has.
Well, what kind of success have you had in getting people to comply? Because at the end of the day, we just want folks that are renting out properties to pay their fair share of the transit accommodation tax, right? You don't want scoff laws.
I think most of the people are in compliance. But I would say, as far as just looking at the ads that are out there, maybe 15% have to still be brought into compliance.
That seems kind of high to me. I don't know.
It is quite high, but there may be some confusion because a lot of people, instead of putting in their tax registration numbers, they put in the numbers for their planning and permitting number, I guess, or their county tax number, as opposed to the state tax registration number. So there's a lot of those that are in there. We also have people that put in a tax registration number, but an expired tax registration number. So we have some of those within that 15%. So it's a process of having to filter out those.
Do you have a good handle on the enforcement action that you have taken, whether you've collected fines?
We have collected fines. We have cited people, and we're continuing to cite people. And the notification you saw was part of that process of warning the people first, and then if they don't remedy their ads, bringing them into the citation.
And do you have a sense as to where the violations are? Are they mainly here on Oahu, or what can you tell us about the neighbor islands? You know, because here on Oahu, right, there are areas that are allowed rentals in resort areas, particular areas of Waikiki. And,
right.
And I know the city's efforts have been really to crack down on these illegal rentals in residential neighborhoods where they can be disruptive to folks that live in the area.
No, the non-compliance we're seeing is basically spans the whole islands, all the islands. Certainly Honolulu has the majority of them because we have the most vacation rentals here. But there's still non-compliance in the other islands, the Big Island, Maui, so on and so forth.
Anything else that you think would be important for our listeners to understand about this action that you folks are taking?
I think people just need to be aware if they receive a communication from the tax department to respond. A lot of people assume that, oh, okay, I put in my registration number, but the registration number they put in is for the county or the Department of Planning and Permitting, and it's not the tax registration number. And so when we warn people, we send in these letters, we try to inform them that, hey, your number is still incorrect and needs to be corrected. But when they don't respond, we have no choice then but to proceed on the next step with regarding to citing them.
And fining them.
Right.
And then do you have a lot of problems with owners that don't live here in Hawaii, in the state?
I think there's a significant proportion of those people that do reside out of state. They're not residents of Hawaii. And so, yes, we do end up trying to reach those people and to warn those people that, you know, their ad for a vacation rental is non-compliant.
Yeah, the bottom line is we do want to be able to collect the tax because our budgets are tight, right? And if folks
absolutely
are not paying their fair share, that's not right.
Ultimately, that's the end goal, is to make sure that everybody pays their fair share. But the first step is making sure they're complying with this ad so that we're aware of their tax registration number. Makes it easier then to be able to check on that registration number to see if the taxes are being filed.
Meanwhile, the city says that since a new ordinance went into effect to make it easier for its inspectors to crack down on illegal short-term rental advertising, it has issued more than 2,000 notices of violation Just from July of last year to July of 2025, it has issued more than 1,200. But the Department of Planning and Permitting says it is in the throes of working out the bugs on a new online system. And while it believes its numbers are up even more since it began enforcing the ordinance, it's in the process of verifying those figures. We hope to hear more about the progress in its crackdown of illegal rentals.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring 100% Hawaiian coffees, espresso bites, subscriptions, and more. Online at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
Is dotted with ghost towns. They were abandoned in the mid-20th century as part of a government effort to consolidate a sparse population.
Some of them were shut down more forcibly than others.
But not everyone left for good. We'll hear that story and the top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
It is day 27 of the government shutdown, the second longest in U.S. history. The Department of Agriculture told states it will not provide payments in November for SNAP. 42 million Americans rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Governor Josh Green has authorized $100 million from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program to offset the loss for families in Hawaii, but uncertainty for the future looms large. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson recently spoke with one resident who relies on SNAP assistance for his groceries. Wallace Suinaga is from Kohala on the island of Hawaii. We met him at Safeway in Aiea. Suinaga is a retired commercial pilot. He had his own flight school, and he said he made good money back in the day. But things have changed for him in retirement, particularly with cutbacks administered by the second Trump administration. We asked Suinaga, what's in your cart?
So you just bought a couple of items here today. What did you come to the store for today?
Some ice cream, because it's hot, and a bag of chips.
Sounds like it's going to be a good night of snacks.
Well, yeah, I just had a big lunch, so.
Do you buy a lot of ice cream? Is that something you buy regularly? You can be honest.
Yeah.
And have you noticed the price of ice cream changing at all? Has it stayed the same over, say, the last several months?
Pretty much the same when they have it. Sometimes they're out of it. They had it today.
Are there different items, maybe on larger shopping trips, that you've noticed have become really more expensive this year?
Pretty much. I'm usually on food stamps, but I only get $60 worth of food stamps because they said I make too much, but I'm retired and I don't get that much pay. You know, just Social Security, but who knows how long that'll last with the budget shutdown and everything else. I'm not sure, but $60 lasts me maybe a week or less.
And that's for the month, right?
That's for the month.
So, and has that shrunk? Like, do you feel like maybe a while ago that $60 could be stretched for 2 weeks or?
Well, I used to have $400, but they cut me down. I don't know why, but I guess they're doing it to everybody.
When did they cut you down?
The last time I had to do the re-up, it was like in August or something.
And so they just explained to you that you make too much money otherwise?
Yeah, but I've been making the same since the last, you know, time I did the re-up, re-examination.
And SNAP benefits are one of those things that the Trump administration has been talking about cutting back. So it sounds like, do you have fears that it might be reduced to nothing? Or do you feel confident that you'll keep getting that $60?
I think they're going to do away with it, you know, eventually. But I don't know how, because everybody's on the program pretty much. Even the unemployed, you know.
if you had, you know, President Trump here or any politician here that was involved in the decision-making process, what would you say to them in terms of trying to communicate to them the importance of the SNAP benefits in your life?
Well, I think they should increase it, you know, to the needs of the people, but I guess they're not listening. You know, I'm not sure. It's all PR to me, you know.
The politics of it all feels like PR.
Yeah.
That was Wallace Suminaga talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson. How has the federal uncertainty and the government shutdown been affecting your spending? Write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It was supposed to be a film about a walk across America to raise awareness for diabetes and obesity. Before the Moon Falls turns into a much darker documentary once its star, a Samoan writer, is arrested for murder. Sia Figel is currently on trial for the 2024 murder of Caroline Sinaviana Gabbert. Gabbert was an author and sister of Senator Mike Gabbert and aunt of Tulsi Gabbert. Kimberly Bassford directed and produced a documentary about Figel. Before the Moon Falls made its U.S. debut at the Hawaii International Film Festival to acclaim. It tied for first place for the festival's Made in Hawaii Award. Bassford spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the challenges she faced as she made the documentary and how she became wrapped up in Figel's story. It was after Figel called the filmmaker to tell her about a suicide attempt. And a note, this interview discusses heavy themes of mental health and violent crime.
At first, I really thought I was an observer, you know, as a documentarian. You know, you definitely have influence, you know, just having a camera there obviously impacts how people behave. But for the most part, you're trying to minimize that as much as possible, be more like a fly on the wall. And so when she first started sharing her internal struggles, I was there to listen. Of course, you know, we did sort of these informal interviews, but I really thought I was more of an observer to her journey. It really wasn't until a couple more years later that I really crossed, I guess, that line from being more of an observer to an active participant. And that was the moment that she called me, actually, to tell me about what had happened in her life. And at that point, it seemed from what she shared with me that I was the only person who knew what had happened and that she was sharing this information with. And that was a lot. I mean, just in the moment when you're on the phone with someone and they're sharing this and you get a sense that they're in crisis, you just have to just react. And I thought the thing I needed to do was to help her, not just to be an observer, but to actively encourage her to get some support, if not to like actually take her to the place to get support. So that's really where I feel like things shifted a lot for me as the documentarian. And then after that, it was, yeah, constantly questions that I had myself of, what role am I? I've crossed the line and I'm the storyteller, but I'm also her support network and I'm also a friend. And it was really tough to navigate. And I just sort of did it the best I could each day at a time.
I mean, the elephant in the room that we haven't spoken about yet is that Sia is on trial right now for the murder of a woman who you interviewed for the documentary. And so now knowing that this is the way the story had turned out, are there certain moments that you reflect on?
When the news came out, so that was in May 2024, is when I found out that Sia had been arrested in Samoa. It was not a murder charge at first. It was manslaughter, and then it got upgraded to a murder charge. And then I think even a couple days later, that's when I found out the victim's name, who is Dr. Caroline Sinaviana Gabbert, who is somebody that we actually filmed with Sia many years prior. So we filmed with them in 2018 here in Hawaii, actually. So when I finally got all of that information, you know, it still took a lot of time to process, because I wasn't in touch with Sia. She was in custody, and I didn't know what had happened, really, besides what sort of reports I was getting. And I had to figure out what I was going to do with this project. Do we continue? Would anybody even want to see a film about someone now who has been charged with these really, you know, horrific charges? And so, yeah, we took some time to just sort of wait and see, to talk with our advisors, with our partners, to just try and get more information about what was going on, because this was all happening in Samoa. But ultimately, we decided to continue forward with the project. I felt pretty strongly, just my personal reaction after having spent at that point 8 years of my life filming with her, I felt it had to have something to do with her mental health, that maybe her condition had worsened and there had been something that potentially some kind of episode. So that was, you know, the only thing I could explain to myself of what had happened. But I didn't know yet. I hadn't talked to Sia or anybody. So yeah, we had to just take sort of baby steps, you know, just kind of get as much information and then figure out what to do. But this film was always meant to be a compassionate portrait of a woman trying to heal. And that's how we had approached the story from, you know, the beginning, well, especially since we knew it was going to be about mental health. And I felt like the murder didn't really change that. I mean, obviously now we have a horrible, tragic ending, one that we could have never imagined. But it was still a story of this woman who had these ups and downs and unfortunately this terrible event. So I thought it was important to continue telling that story so that it could bring some level of understanding and insight to maybe what happened and what led Sia to this moment.
You filmed what was supposed to be the last interview with Sia in 2024, just months before she allegedly committed this murder. What was the documentary supposed to look like at that point?
We were basically at almost a fine cut stage, which is sort of the last cut before final cut, like before you have your finished film. So we were pretty far along, and the last time I saw Sia was in March 2024, so it's 2 months before the murder. And it was supposed to be our final shoot together. We did a final interview. We did some final filming with her, as well as this young girl who you see in the film who sort of evokes Sia as a child. So it was the final shoot. And as far as I could tell, I mean, everything actually seemed like it was going pretty well for Sia. She seemed pretty settled in Samoa and really excited about a lot of the creative work she was doing at the time. And when I said goodbye to her, I said goodbye and I said, I'm going to go edit the footage we just shot and share the fine cut with you. And that's where we were, actually. We had just finished the fine cut when I got the news about her being arrested. So in that film, when you ask, like, what was the film that we had, it was a film where actually the abuse issues were more the central thread. And the mental health was there, obviously, but it was really about the abuse that she experienced as a young child. And that's what she was really wanting this film to highlight, because she felt like if she had gotten support when she was younger, because that's the thing that had, you know, stayed with her for so many years and I think impacted so many of her decisions throughout life. So that's what our film was supposed to be moving toward. And that's what we had in our cut in May. And then, of course, I found out about her arrest. And then once I found about that, I realized the abuse is still in the film, but that the mental illness had to become the major thread. Yeah. Because it could not be. Like, you couldn't have this ending without that being there. So that was always there, but then we did have to go back through our footage and see what else we had there to sort of help the audience on that journey to understanding how she got to that point.
It feels like putting the film together to an audience was maybe an exercise in making it make sense to yourself.
It was, and I'm really fortunate. I have a wonderful team. I mean, our editor is Jessica Lee Salas. She's based in New Jersey. And, of course, my producing partner, Linda Goldstein-Knowlton. So, you know, it's kind of like the three of us are really like, okay, how do we retell this story? Because originally in the fine cut, we had a hopeful ending. So we had actually footage of Sia at her younger son's high school graduation. And you actually see her older son's high school graduation in the film, and she's sort of in a low moment. And then we had footage of her at her younger son's high school graduation where she was feeling very optimistic about the future, and she had just sort of reconciled with her sister. And that was supposed to be the ending. So it was supposed to have this hopeful ending of, like, she is on her way to healing. She's resolving these issues. Her family is sort of united again. And then, obviously, in real life, there was much more complicated than that. But with the murder, we couldn't have that in the film anymore. And then also, once the murder happened, I did have to go through, because I remember I had filmed with Dr. Gabbard. And so I had to go through and look at that footage and decide whether or not that should now be in the film. And I think it needed to be, since, you know, I think the audience wouldn't want to know, like, what is their relationship with one another. And they were friends. And I wanted just the footage to show that they were friends, you know, and to show that they had a deep mutual respect for one another.
There's something quite jarring about watching that footage, even years later, knowing what the outcome is and knowing how Dr. Gabbard speaks about Sia. There was something you said a moment ago about you wanted to, and you did make a compassionate film about somebody struggling with mental health. And I wonder if you see a line between compassion and sympathy, particularly thinking about Dr. Gabbard and her legacy, whether you thought about doing her justice and what could come up with such a compassionate view of Sia.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of things to navigate with this film. And, you know, I don't know that I always made the right decisions. I made the decisions I could make with the information I had. But I wanted it to be a compassionate portrait of Sia. I also wanted to honor Dr. Gabbard in the film, and so that she's not a nameless victim, so that she had some, you know, you knew a little bit about her. And yeah, we try to do both. I mean, it's difficult, you know, it's difficult as someone who knows Sia, and there's a lot of people out there who know Sia, and, you know, it's not this is just impacting me, but we all sort of, I mean, I've had conversations with others who have known her, and I think we all kind of wrestle with this, you know, and I think it just goes back to how humans are very complex, and how do you hold a person's full humanity, right? Like, I think in some ways I started this project because I admire Sia so much as a writer, as this literary force, and I still do. I think her writing is very important to Pacific literature, but that's just part of her. And, you know, she's always had these struggles that she has kept fairly invisible to people. And that's part of who she is, too. And unfortunately, there's a lot of pain and darkness as well. And I think that's just also part of being human. You know, I think cinema and films and storytelling is about, it's not, this film doesn't give you a lot of easy answers, you know, and I don't know. It's difficult. You know, it's tough to film with her for 8 years. You know, we had a lot of wonderful moments, and then we had a lot of tough moments, and I think you see both of that in the film, and I think that's also just a kind of indicative of this story. How do you reconcile for yourself somebody who does this thing that's, you know, it's very difficult? I mean, we don't have Dr. Gabbard here anymore, and that's really sad, and it's not fair. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah.
I put it all in the film, and I think it's like, it's hard. It's like, is this a film where people are going to watch and they're going to have their own different reactions? And I've heard from many people, it's a film that kind of stays with people. Like, you watch it, and then even like a few days later, a few weeks later, you might still be thinking about it because it's tough. Like, these are tough questions. How do you reconcile like all of these extremes that Sia represents of like who we are as people?
Knowing what you know now, would you have
made this film? Would I have made this film? Gosh, yeah, I don't know. Probably not. I mean, if I knew what I knew now, I mean, it's tough. It's, you know, with documentaries, you start out one way, and I mean, most documentaries don't always end up the way you think, but this is like way beyond what I could have ever imagined the story would have gone. Yeah, probably would have made like a feel-good film of some kind, because I think that would have been a lot easier for me.
That was filmmaker Kimberly Bassford talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. Bassford's film is titled Before the Moon Falls. It follows the Samoan novelist Sia Figuel, who is currently on trial for murder. Lawyers presented closing arguments in the trial last month. The judge has not yet issued a ruling. The documentary film will be shown on October 30th at Consolidated Theaters Kapolei, a location, and on November 16th at the Palace Theater in Hilo as part of the Hawaii International Film Festival. Look for links on our website later today. And if you or a loved one is struggling with mental health issues, call or text Hawaii Cares at 988.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Are you passionate about local journalism, skilled at identifying a range of voices and perspectives? HPR is hiring a full-time producer to work on The Conversation, our flagship daily news and talk show. Read the full job description and apply at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
This past weekend, an event at the State Art Museum, Capitol Modern, featured Bay Area rapper Ruby Ibarra. This month happens to be Filipino American History Month, and here to talk about Ibarra's art is HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me, and yeah. Mabuhay.
Mabuhay. You know, I was not familiar with Ibarra's work, but it was really intriguing.
She's a fellow Bay Area native, a Bay Area artist. Actually, Ruby Ibarra is originally from the Philippines, and she and her mother immigrated to the United States when she was about 4 years old, where she grew up in San Lorenzo, California, which is East Bay, which is right across the bridge from San Mateo, and just a little bit south of Oakland. But yeah, she really drew a crowd at Capitol Modern this Saturday. Actually, hundreds from the Filipino community showed up. They were super hyped. Ruby Ibarra and her band were like the main headliners. But even before they headlined the event during that Saturday, we actually got to see some local artists too, which are Filipino hip hop artists. So it was really cool to see. I actually got to speak with Ruby Ibarra and, you know, her perspective on the growing Filipino artistry and hip hop.
And I think just to be able to offer that unique perspective of who I am as a Filipina, my own unique experiences, and to have that amplified on a broad stage such as NPR, to have my story reach people that it wouldn't otherwise have reached, has been such a blessing. And of course, coming with the NPR win has also brought in a plethora of opportunities. So I'm definitely very grateful for the acknowledgement. But it's also a reminder that, you know, we don't need these kinds of spaces to necessarily validate ourselves as artists. And I think it serves as a gentle reminder that we've been on the right path all along. And there are people who appreciate the music, and our stories and our voices are necessary, especially in a moment like now. And, you know, a lot of immigrant voices are being silenced in this country. And so I think that's why, you know, coupled with what's been going on in this country, that's why our win is actually more important and bigger than ourselves. It's beyond the music.
Yeah, you often hear that, oh, if you make it to the Tiny Desk concert, you've really made it.
And she's not stopping there. And the song that actually won the contest was Bakunawa. And Bakunawa was inspired by Filipino mythology, which is the moon-eating dragon. And then also her mother, Ruby Ibarra, is a mother now. And she wanted to pay ode to her in that song. But this isn't the first time that they performed at Tiny Desk concert, actually, back in 2019. They performed the same song, but they didn't win. I've seen interviews of Ibarra in the past, and she said she was a little bit bummed out, but she still kept trying. But I believe we have a clip of a Bakunawa, actually. Na parang diamante, Pilipina na babae, hindi dalaga militante. Ako ang Bakunawa, nakatira sa dilim. Akala mo nakatago. Yeah, and there's been a growing presence of Filipino artistry, especially in the hip-hop realm. You have Black Eyed Peas, actually. They actually have an artist who's Filipino who also raps about the issues that's going on in the Philippines. You have Jay Mara, Moro Beats. They rap more about political corruptions in the Philippines. But you have folks like Ruby Ibarra, Easy Mill, Carl Angelo, and even more who are rapping about things that are closer to home, like the immigrant experience, facing language barriers. Colorism is also a topic that they talk about in their lyrics. But it is continuing to grow. We are seeing more of that artistry because hip hop has been kind of a force of political storytelling, social activism, and demand for social change. In Hawaii, Jazan Exclusive, also known as Jazan Amoto, has been a rising Filipina hip hop artist, and she raps about being local and how her family came to the U.S. from the Philippines.
For me, like, hip hop is just so raw and uncut still. Even as I, you know, I'm a millennial, so I'm entering like other spaces where I see like more high school kids, college kids coming up, even the youth and young people that came out tonight. It's just forever growing. And I feel like there's no other genre that really lets us kind of freestyle and be free in what we share. And hip hop was like rooted in political activism and almost like radicalism too. So from like the African-American community and the Latino community. And I think that's important to keep going as someone who still like loves and cares about hip hop culture, no matter like where the mainstream goes.
I spoke to some concert goers actually on Saturday who are of Filipino descent, and they said that this kind of music is actually healing to them. You don't really get to see a lot of Filipino hip hop artists really talk about the social struggles that they face here in the United States. And they said artists like Ruby Ibarra really helps them tell their authentic stories. I also got to speak with Ruby Ibarra's band first, like Chen of the Balikbayans and Astrologic, and they said that people are ready to hear this kind of music and storytelling from the Filipino diaspora.
This music's not for me, it's for the people, you know? This music is really for everybody, the community, whatever tribe you're from, whatever clan you're from, whatever island you're from. If you resonate, you resonate. It's spirit music for us, you know? And like how Angelo says, it comes from the soul, because it's our experience, you know? It's in our DNA already, you know? It's ancestral. This is what we freaking been through, you know? And we all resonate with it because, or the people who are ready resonate with it because we're ready. People are ready to hear this kind of stuff.
They said it with their chest, too. People are ready to hear this kind of music of the diaspora and being Filipino.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't heard this before, but it's intriguing. I kind of like it.
And also, just to highlight, Ruby Ibarra actually performed in front of her mother. Along with Bakunawa, she also performed 7,000 Miles, which is about the immigrant experience and through her mother's lens. And there wasn't a single dry eye, according to her band members, that her mom was crying right in front of her as she was performing.
Yeah, I'm sure that was very powerful. But yeah, it's just you know, the Filipino community is so talented and so creative, and it's just really nice to see, you know, the young voices, the young creatives getting out there and making their mark.
We're definitely taking the non-traditional route. Being Filipino, did not become a nurse, so took the artistry route.
Right, yeah, that's awesome. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Look for her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Yeah. Write my stories now, paint the cover now. My feet are running, but my soul is planted on the ground. Break the labels down, make them hear my sound. Can't touch a book by its cover, can you read me now? We wanna break free. No, you can't paint me, I feel like 8 feet. They thinking I'm crazy, but listen, lately I'm choosing to be all the things that make me. They try to judge me and they try to read me. Put me in a box, break the locks, never stop. So another docks, off the top, flip a hot, take a one book.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Cameron Crowe, who made the films Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Jerry Maguire, Say Anything, and Almost Famous. His new memoir shows how his life parallels Almost Famous. The story of how a boy in his mid-teens gets to write about his rock heroes for Rolling Stone and grows up along the way. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union, featuring home equity lines of credit. More about HELOC at hawaiistatefcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
Observant ears may have picked up on a new classical music host here at HPR. Marcus Moore is a musician, a teacher, and composer who came to Hawaii when he served in the Marine Corps Forces Pacific Band. He holds a master's degree in music composition from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and he's currently working on a certificate in conflict resolution at the Matsunaga Institute for Peace. Moore has been hosting Evening Concert on HPR2 since September, and he recently spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his path in music and what drives his shows on Evening Concert.
I am what you would call a late bloomer. I started at the end of my middle school life on saxophone, and I was in choir in late elementary school and early middle school, but the program was cut due to funding, so I just kind of wandered as a musician. I always liked music, but there was a time where I just was like, okay, I guess I like music, but I'm not going to do it anymore. And the band director at my middle school was walking around in the gym with the clipboard and just walked to everybody individually, like, do you want to join band? Do you want to join band? She came up to me. I said, nope, no. And then I had a friend sitting to my right and another on my left. They were like, oh, no, dude, that's like an easy 100. You should do it. And I'm all about having good grades. So I went back to her and said I'd do it. And then that was me in seventh grade. And then eighth grade, I picked up the saxophone. Then I transferred schools up to North Atlanta to Southside High School. Fantastic band program there. And I remember watching our top band at the time. I was in our lowest band, last chair in our lowest band. Oh, and playing Barry Sax too. And I remember watching the top three chairs in the top band play clarinet, and I was just kind of amazed by how the fluidity and the fidelity in their fingers. I was like, oh, those look like dance moves. That's like really cool to watch. And so I ended up transferring schools again, and I went down to Rutland High School in Macon, Georgia, where I told my band director, I don't want to play Barry Sax, I want to play clarinet. It's like, do you have one? No. So you gonna play it? I'm like, yes. And the rest is history. Now I have a great career as a clarinetist, but it started like that. Last chair saxophone player who didn't want to do it, very lazy, to, oh yeah, I love practicing my scales every day. I love teaching my students, love scales, play Brahms, eat your vegetables, play long tones, because I love doing it.
Wow. Do you think you showed innate talent as a young musician, as a saxophonist, or then as a clarinetist?
As a saxophonist, not really. The music wasn't very difficult. I could get it really quickly, though. But when I picked up the clarinet, something sort of shifted. I became very fascinated again with having looked at, wow, the fidelity of the fingers. I want to be able to do that, too. So I just found as much music as possible. And my band director at the time, Scott Matthews, just took me into his library and said, this was after school on a random day of the week, no marching band practice. He's like, I want you to come here and I'm just going to give you all this music. Go home and practice. And I would go home and practice like 6 to 8 hours every single day up until the night. And my neighbors were never upset with me. My family was never upset. They let me practice up until the wee hours of the night until I got tired. I physically could not even talk sometimes. That's how much I used to practice.
Wow.
And that continued forth. So the innate ability wasn't there, but the determination was there.
Do you think that influences some of the perspective you have as a teacher and educator, knowing your own path and that sort of knowing when to put a little bit of pressure on a student can be really influential? So how do you look at your own path as a way to predict how your current students might perform?
That's a really good question. Many of the students I've gotten have been very hungry like me, and they came from the same sort of socioeconomic background I came from. It was a little rough for me as a kid, but I've worked with many kids who've not had instruments, who've not had the resources. So I actually teach a lot of lessons for free just because. It's like my teacher was very lenient with me during some of these moments. And I very much look at them and I'm like, if you're hungry, I'm going to feed you. But understand, the meals that I'm preparing are not just surface level. I'm trying to teach you how to feed yourself. And as much as I like to attune a lot of what I've experienced to my teaching, as in this is how to schedule, this is what it's like when you're tired, how to take care of yourself, I've had to be very cognizant of not putting too much pressure on students, because what children and especially young adults go through now is many of them are living a reality that's very different than my own. Many of them work, many of them are in multiple classes. Like, I went to a school where I could focus a lot on music. I could focus. Like, a lot of these kids are stretched in AP classes here, this, there. I'm also in track and field. I'm in football. I'm in art, and I do theater. And so I have to be understanding I didn't do all of that. I was in music. So how do I not lessen my own knowledge of the craft to meet? I don't want to lessen myself, but how do I give you a piece of what I offer that kind of hits the wickets of what you're currently going through? So it's a lot of curating what I've experienced to my students, and then also taking from the great educators I've worked with and applying that based off what my students are going through.
I want to talk about more how you ended up here and what came first, the Marine Corps or the conflict resolution graduate certificate.
Yeah, there's so much there. As like with clarinet, I was approached and I was preparing for my last recital. So I gave two. I was my super senior year, so my fifth year of my undergrad, for clarinet performance. And at the time, I think I was playing the Cromer Concerto for two clarinets. And a good colleague of mine, Lauren, she agreed to play it with me. And so we played it for my teacher. He recorded it and put it online. And I didn't think much of it. I'm like, okay, he does this to me a lot. But a recruiter from the Marine Corps saw it and he messaged me. It's like, oh, do you want to join the Marine Corps? I'm like, no. But then he started talking the same thing. I was like, he's like, this is a really good way to play music. And he was doing the
Your friend next
thing.
To you said it's an easy A.
It was crazy. I was also on the phone with the friend at the time I got the message. A French horn player was like, dude, you should totally do this. You get paid to work out. I'm like, oh, well, that's easy money. So I said yes. But little did I know I would fall in love with it. Like, I love the Corps. I don't serve anymore, but I still work with Marines. And I served my 4 years, had a great time, very good friends, great musical experiences around the world. And at the height of that, I was up on a choice as to what would come next. I could stay in, I could go back to school for clarinet, because I really wanted to teach again. I was starting to miss it. And as much as I love the Marine Corps, I didn't want to teach Marines how to be Marines. I wanted to teach musicians how to be musicians. So in the height of all of it, I heard this little voice like said to me one day, just, you should say goodbye. And at that moment, I felt my body shift and I looked at my clarinet cases on the floor and it was like, I have to say goodbye to you. Something said, say goodbye. I'm like, oh, what is God telling me? Say goodbye. Okay, bye. And I did, but it felt like a relief. And shortly after that, I had a friend of mine who I'd played Dungeons and Dragons with every Sunday for 3 years straight. I was arranging music for the Marine Corps at the time, the staff arranger. And all the time when we would be sitting in our sessions, our DM would be playing music and I could just name exactly what album that came off of, who that soloist was, what this was, who the orchestra recorded it, what year, who produced it. I could just do that. And I remember talking to her. She's like, you're really good at that. I'm like, oh, I enjoy it. I just wish I could listen to more things that really get me excited. I don't hear them as much anymore. I remember going through undergrad just like, oh, this is new. This is new. I like this. I don't like this. And I want to find more of that. And she's a composer. And I was like, so how do you find that as a composer? She says, I write it. And maybe you should too. Light bulb. And so I ended up applying for graduate schools around the world. And I ended up choosing to go to University of Hawaii at Manoa to get a master's degree in music composition. That was amazing. Love my professors from there. Fantastic people. And in the middle of that process, there was a doctoral student who was also getting her PhD in music composition. She is still currently working on getting a graduate certificate in conflict resolution from the Matsunaga Institute of Peace. And we were having breakfast one day, just or brunch, I would say, and just talking story, talking about music, talking about our passions. And I mentioned to her, I was like, I'm going to Africa to go do some community building and working out and doing some peace building in Tanzania, playing music, teaching music to young kids, rebuilding the Mpingo population. She was like, have you heard of the Matsunaga Institute of Peace? No. With everything else, this is the theme of my life. No, I've not heard of this. No, I don't want to do this. But then I said yes, because she told me about it. And she was explaining the trajectory and the goals behind the Institute and introduced me to the people there. So now I've had my master's degree, served in the Marine Corps. I'm working on getting a graduate certificate in conflict resolution from the Matsunaga Institute of Peace. And it has been tough. It's a little tricky juggling a couple things, but I'm enjoying the material. It's making me think a lot more about how I internalize things and how to then externalize it to help other people through whatever conflicts they have.
I'm sure listeners have gotten the impression that you're a very thoughtful person. You recently took over hosting one night a week on evening concert on HPR2. Tell us a little bit about how you go about selecting music and choosing and shaping your shows.
I love that question. And also, I love working for HPR. This has been such an honor. And it's like I get to sit down and listen to music with people. And it comes from a couple different places as to how I pick things. I'm very thematic. I can pick a simple thing such as nature, which was last week's show. And the show before that was, or at least especially when I came in, I'm like, okay, ballet is my first show because that's a statement of who I am. I love ballet, favorite type of classical music to listen to. But then the next thing is, all right, it's September, Spanish Heritage Month. Let's go. There's so many great Spanish composers, so many great pieces that highlight Spanish heritage. So I wanted to pick music that did that, that sent that message. And not just orchestral music. I think there's a great, great repertoire of wind band works, chamber works, choral works, chamber ensembles, intercultural music. So not just Western, not the Western diaspora, but like going into the far Eastern side. Like I'll be exploring a lot of that, is like how there's a whole story to tell there about classical music, quote unquote classical music, through the entire worldly view. And so I base a lot of my choices on these themes, and I look at the world to see where in the planet has this concept come up. So in my shows, I mention, okay, we'll be here in Europe, be a little bit in South America, here's North America, and I'll be bringing it in, and I'll have a theme. But then the next part is, it comes in two segments. It's, well, many of the pieces I've picked out, especially in the wind band and orchestral world, I've performed them. As a performer, I'm like, oh, now it's just nice to listen to this again and not think about the feelings involved with learning the repertoire, but just to sit back and also speak on those experiences as, this is how I'm connected to this piece, or this is how I know this composer. And then the part of me that wishes I could hear some of these things in program is like, how off? It's probably highly unlikely we'll get the Frozen Cathedral and Maslenka's Fourth Symphony on the same program unless you really want to tire your ensemble out. That's rare, but to hear them at least in some form of music, I think that's exciting. So curating playlists along the lines of, I wish I could hear an ensemble do Maslenka 4 and John Mackey's Frozen Cathedral on the same night. Well, we can on my show.
Well, Marcus Moore, thank you for hopping over the radio band frequency, going into the other control room to spend some time with us here.
Oh, yeah, this has been great.
That was musician and classical music host Marcus Moore talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. You can catch Moore hosting Evening Concert on HPR2 on Friday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. That's it for us today. Tomorrow we hear about a new report out on after-school care and learn why so many families in Hawaii are having trouble accessing these programs. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.